Let me on the outside. Concerning the statement, is one can only know the modification of one's own substance. That's in the emphatic. Does the statement imply individual substance, human substance, or both? It's a long statement, so we'll start drawing immediately, I think. We'll anticipate some of the question about working out the implications. The paper represents sentient power itself. This is the absolute cause of all beings. It is awareness and power to initiate motion. When it waves, it is aware that it waves. We use the term substance when we are talking from outside towards a center. And this we call down. The limiting factor for a substance is the circumscribing line. Substance is really power. Matter is power. And this power must rotate in order to deserve to take the name of matter. And it must have the power rotating round the center and be observed from above in order to deserve the name of substance, the understanding. Now, if we imagine for a moment a finite being with a determined edge, we could say that represents an egg, like a monocelled animal, or if we like to complicate the pattern a bit, we could say this is the pattern of a human being. We've merely distorted the outline of it, but we haven't altered the fundamental principle that the line is a circumscribing line, and therefore everything internal to that line, viewed from outside and offering a resistance as rotating power does, is called a substance. Now, if the being is finite, it becomes immediately obvious that it cannot possibly know anything other than the modifications of itself. When the stimulus comes, the receiving being knows nothing whatever about the origin of that stimulus, if it is a finite being. It only knows that its surface is irritated by it. That if you look at the light, what you actually get is a sensation in your retina. So if there is your eye, and you've got a lens on it, and the retina at the back, this retina sends an impulse. And if you point the eye in different directions, the amount of stimulation of your substance varies. And because it varies, without willed intent on the part of your substance, then you assume a source external to yourself. You remember this rule: if the change in one's substance occurs without will from within, it is assumed to have an external origin. Here is a finite being. The being itself is power, and this power is sentient. So it is feeling itself. It is a power, and the nature of motion is cyclic within this being, and so it is substantiating itself, building power in, so that he can stand as a reference for consciousness. When a stimulus comes from outside, a change of motion is initiated on the edge of the being. It is not initiated from the center of the being, and because it is not initiated from the center, it is assumed that the change on the perimeter is caused by a being external to this binding line. The only way we come to believe in an external world for us is because changes are occurring on our perimeter which we have not ourselves willed to produce. We have no other evidence for an external world other than the things happen which we do not will. We have to account for these. If we discover the will centre, the centre of initiative in ourselves, as when we open the hand and close it from within, then we have some sensation of a self, of initiative, an internal spirit, an initiative center. Force is going out and producing changes in the substance, as when I send from inside myself a message to make a mark on the paper, centrally initiated. On the other hand, if when I'm drawing a mark, somebody throws a banana at me and it hits me on the knuckle and makes my line wiggle, because my line wiggle was not intended by me, I assume an external origin for the stimulus. We see that in the case of the finite being, it is perfectly obvious that it cannot possibly know anything other than the modifications of its own substance, and that the so-called external world is a world projected intellectually to account for changes in the substance of the being which have not been initiated from the center. Now we're going up or down. Let's look at the field of the absolute, and we'll draw a few circles, as we know they exist, within, of various sizes. We can go on drawing, as you know, these circles wherever we like. The centre of each circle is the initiating force, which starts a ripple with energy going out. The thing that causes that initiating force in advancing its front to have a limiting factor is the existence of another centre of another circle, which centre, pushing out its own energy, limits the energy coming forth from another centre. So if we remove, for a moment, conceptually, all centres from the universe except one, and that one is infinite power, the power goes out and never gets a perimeter. It just continuously propagates in all directions, but it never gets a perimeter because there's nothing to oppose it. So it must flow out infinitely. In that case, we would have an infinite progression of power with no limiting factor and therefore no form. To make a limiting factor, we must set another centre up, and the power from this other centre starts coming out, likewise expanding circularly, and at a certain point it will meet the outflowing energy from the other centre. Now this place where the outflowing energies from two centres meet is called the firmament in the book of Genesis. The original word from which this word is derived, and which causes firm to be used in the translation, means to be hammered out. To be hammered out like a metal smith, hammered out a plate of metal. You put it on, say, a wooden base, and you hit it with a hammer from above. Now, the wooden base resists the blow of the hammer, and the metal between is made thinner in shape. So being hammered from two sides is the cause of the firmament. We see that if we get two centres, and they are both sending energy out, at a certain point the energies will meet, press on each other, and produce a line between them, a limiting factor. This limiting factor is the firmament between any two centres. Now, apart from centres of initiative, we have the field, the outflowing zone of the power, and the limiting factor. The definition of a field is the zone of influence of a force. The zone of influence is relative, because although these two centres produce a firmament between them, the outflowing powers from both sides are hitting on the firmament and vibrating it. So the firmament is also a reflection point. Now this reflection is the basis of the possibility of the evolution of any centre to the level of a self-reflexive being, a being of self, consciousness. The being propagating itself infinitely could meet with no resistance and therefore could never become reflexive. Reflex means bends back. So without two centres, there could be no reflection. When there are two centres, the energy from one centre goes out, hits against the resistance of the other centre and bends back. Now this is the ground of reflexive self-consciousness. There must be resistance. This is why William Blake says, opposition is true friendship. If people will not resist you at all, you cannot reflect. You cannot discover what you've said. You cannot discover the meaning of what you've said unless somebody will oppose you. So if you make a statement and nobody says anything whatever, you don't know how it's been received. If you're very good at observing muscle changes, you'll discover that they have said something, usually, even if they have not opened their mouths. You can read disapproval on their faces quite easily. The important thing is that without a centre being opposed by another centre, no firmament can arise. Without the firmament, no reflection is possible. And without this reflection from the opposition, self-consciousness and self-control and self-creativity is impossible. Now, if a being knows only the modifications of its own substance, then we have to consider the possibility of identification with a given zone. Because if we are considering finite being in an infinite field, we can only be considering a zone of identification. If there are two centres here, and the paper itself represents the sentient power, that is the power that is aware of itself. This paper, which is sentient power, is the absolute substance of all of us. And it is aware of both centres. It is aware, actually, of an infinite number of centres. But that same paper has the power, through the production of centres, and by centres, the production of firmaments, or dividing lines between centres, where the opposition is. These dividing lines are the lines where we can, if we will, identify finity. The man who identifies with his substance as far as the perimeter of his body, say his skin surface, is receiving messages and knowing only things that occur within the boundary of that skin surface. And he is receiving those and understanding only those merely because those and those only are what he's identified with. If he likes to remember a little bit of elementary science of today and know that there is no particle of matter without a field around it, then he will know that he does not finish as a field being with his skin surface. He then tries to feel, and this has become field aware, his extension, the extension of his power beyond the limit of his skin surface. The rule still holds. He's still aware of the modifications of his own substance. Only his own substance now means something beyond the limiting factor of the skin surface. We can say that his own surface is the zone of the power which comes from his immanent self. That's H-I-S. Now, ISH is Ish in Ishva and so on, and the same in Ishu. The centre from which issues the power, and the zone of influence of that power is the field. So as far as you can carry your power out and become aware of the limit to which it goes, that is your substance, and that is the zone of your knowledge. Now, this I think replies to the part of this question that says, when is the limitation of knowing only one substance removed? The answer is when you break identification with any given limiting factor. If you scrub out any limiting factor as you come to it, your substance is simply becoming wider and wider and wider, because your substance is the field power, which is the very ground of your being. If you scrub out all limitations whatever, another difficult job, you become absolute, and your knowledge is then on the same order. When does involving energy become substantial? The perimeter of the gross body and the involving energy field appear to the sensorium as being clearly defined when other considerations point to a more gradual compacting of energy. The question of gradual compaction is not really raised in relation to the use of the term substance. It doesn't matter whether the energies are not tightly compact. The point is there a circumscription? If there is a circumscription at all, then we are justified in using the word substance. Power is involved. If a lot of power is involved, we would say that the mass of this being is increasing. The more power in, the greater mass, in the modern physical sense of mass energy involved in a being. Power is involved in the being. The more power, the greater the mass. We can take a very small volume and pack it very, very densely, as we do in certain solids. We can take the same mass and extend its volume, and it will turn into a liquid and a gas. So that when it's got its greatest extension as a gas, it's still the same mass, but the volume is greater.
Is it still substance?
It's still substance as long as you are considering it to be circumscribed. The B in substance tells you that the spirit power, the SU, has gone into B and is standing underneath. The B is the operative factor, the spirit power binding and standing in that place. So no matter how tenuous it is still a substance. A gas is a substance, a liquid is a substance, a solid is a substance, only because they are bound, and what is bound is power. And it is viewed as something on which one can stand, something underneath oneself on which one stands, and one calls it substance. If one likes to think of it the other way, and look up the etymology of the prefix in substance, we find that it's got an alternative, S-U-B-S-U-P. It can also be superstance, because you can stand in the middle of it and look up. It is then superstance. Which is still the same thing, power, positive, power housed. And we are concerned entirely with this question of, is it closed or not? If it is not closed, we don't call it substance. You can call it few stamps if you want, without the beaming. But as soon as you say the beaming, you have closed it. You pronounce B with closed lips and close it to show that power is involved in it. It is this involvement of power and the closure of the rotation that justifies calling it an absence. So that when we're talking about Aristotle's substance, there should be very great care about the handling of it. If we say God is substance, we are talking about a God, really, called the second God, the demiurge, the creator after the God. Whereas theologically, even in a modern existentialist thinker like the theologian Tillich or somebody like him, you'll find that beyond the God, Logos, which is a substantial being with a body called the body of the Logos or the body of Christ or the cosmic mind body and so on, beyond that there is the God beyond God. In the Gospel of John, this is the God. The God, God. The word God, without any article in the Gospel of John, refers to this Logos, which is the word or ordering substance power. Beyond this closed God is the unclosed God or infinite. But this unclosed God is not an object of worship, because it is not an object at all. Because it is not of. To be of, one must close. And therefore the mystics all say we transcend the worshipped God, if we find the God beyond God, because in finding the infinite, we find that which transcends all boundaries whatever, all limiting factors, and therefore discover something not different from ourself, absolutely. The immanent spirit and the transcendent spirit are not different if we scrub out the action band between them. and about the firmament that to develop between the two. There's a little personal thing added on here, an example of this principle in action. The being of bad temper is accused by B. Is that A, being of bad temper is accused by B? Of being in such condition, he's in a bad temper, I suppose that's the condition. He's in a bad temper condition, and he does so from mnemic associations with the type of field disturbance he has sensed. That means A senses bad temper in B. He does so from mnemic associations, means that he himself internally, when he feels this condition, knows himself to be in a bad temper. So he feels a sensation of motions such as he himself experiences when he is in a state of bad temper. But at the moment he's not in a bad temper. He feels he is not initiating it, but he can still feel it, and it seems to him to be emanating from B. So he says to B, you are in a bad temper. Now, the person accused of being in a bad temper denies it, and the person making the accusation is sure of his diagnosis. What has happened? Well, the man denying it may or may not be in a bad temper, of course. Sometimes the situation is slightly more complicated. We will say for the moment that two beings are aware of each other's existence and they are in relation. They are unaware of a third being. That being can be in the same room or elsewhere. We'll say that A and B are in relation. They are conducting an animated conversation, and suddenly B becomes aware of a change inside himself, of a disability. He doesn't know there's anybody else about, and he knows he hasn't started it, so he assumes that somebody is being bad-tempered. And he then focuses on the only person present, namely A, and says to A, you are in a bad temper. A, feeling his own substance, can feel the irritation in B, denies that A is the originator of this motion, so-called bad temper. B is absolutely certain that he is not responsible, so he's certain that his judgment about A is correct. It may not be. It may be, but it may not be. There may be a third entity getting very annoyed because they're in conversation at all. This can happen in the same room, and it can happen anywhere. As a matter of fact, the other day when I was talking to a qualified gentleman, I call him, while I was talking to him, I suddenly got a very rapid beat in my diaphragm. He hadn't felt it because he was busy with the conversation. And I said, I must go within 10 minutes. And he said, why? I said, because you have a visitor, and when the visitor comes, the visitor will not like to see me here, so I will go. And as soon as I said this, he picked this feeling up. Now, first he thought he picked it up from me, but he hadn't picked it up from me. He picked it up from the visitor. And this visitor was very, very concerned about the health of the qualified gentleman, and was saying, I wonder if he's all right, I wonder if he's all right, I wonder if he's all right, I wonder if he's all right. And that moment was rushing rapidly in a car to find out. So I withdrew from the situation, and the person came in. Now, if I had thought that the source of this diaphragm beat was my immediate companion, I would have been wrong. It wasn't. It was from a very woeful being rushing to protection, and hoping there'd be nobody there to stop the protection process when it started. So we do have to be very careful. We can say statistically that it is highly probable when you accuse a person of being in a bad temper that you will be right. It is highly probable if they are, they will deny it. But that doesn't mean to say that it is necessary. So. And we're not really concerned with statistics, and probability is. We're concerned with immediacy, so that if we do get a feeling of irritation, or even a feeling of non-irritation, a feeling of pleasant warmth and appreciation of one's own personality, it may be a mistake to assume that it's the present person who's doing it. It might have another source. And therefore it's a good idea to refine one's feeling And this we can do only by using our logos mind more and more clearly. The field will give a response to a properly formulated question. It will not give a true response to a badly formed question, because it can't. You remember the fellow who was in court and his wife suing him for divorce, and the judge said to him, "Have you stopped beating your wife? Answer yes or no." Now, he couldn't answer yes or no, because if he said yes, it implied that he had been beating her. And if he said no, it implied he was still at it. In actual fact, he never had. So the question was not one that he could answer yes or no to. If you want a yes or no reply to a question, you must formulate the question in such a way that that's what you can get. Remember, the field itself is full of centers of impulse all over it, and they're all vibrating, and they are vibrating equally unless some stimulus originated in a certain point formulates itself and goes out. So that whatever the stimulus says, it goes to a limit, and the limit is defined by the term you start with, and it produces by its resonance, its internal form, its own firmaments within the infinite field. And it then returns from the defined limiting factor with the information you want. In Jacob Böhme's terms, the soul gives the lift, nature executes. You have to be able to define exactly what you want if you want to get it. To define what you want clearly is to create a tuning device, a conceptual group, which tuning device goes out and impinges upon the forms correspondent with itself, and then returns with that information. All magic is based on correct formulation. While we're at it, we can see another aspect of this. All motion is cyclic, and therefore, from a center, motion initiates, goes out to a limiting factor, its firmament, and then falls on the center. The illustration we can use is that the hand closed is a potential of work. It can indicate, it can punch, it can grasp, it can wave about, and it can duck and fiddle and do all sorts of funny things. Now, on the outgoing curve, this hand is starting as a fish, a seed. It's leaving center, going out, and gradually opening itself. It reaches its full extent, optimal function. When it has done so, the owner of it is fully aware of its significance as a functioning structure. When he's fully aware of it, then it can start coming in again. And again it becomes a seed. So here we have the outgoing, that's the Jupiter function, the hand expressing itself. And when fully expressed, falling in the Saturnine function, which returns it into the equilibrium from which it started. Now, modern neurosis is caused in a very, very simple way. When the hand is going out to express itself, we insert an inhibiting factor on the way out. So the hand starts to open, and we grab hold of it, and we don't let it open. There's a seed here, the potential movements of the hand, the totality of work possibilities of the hand, opening up, and the whole of the energy from centre is behind it. And then there comes a command from society, you can't do that, there we are. An inhibiting factor is put on, and the hand cannot open. At that moment, all the energy from centre piling against the barrier hits the barrier and begins to turbulate. Now the energy from centre, from immanent spirit, is not going to stop. It just goes on piling into that inhibited centre. This is what produces those sudden outflashes of rage or insanity and so on, depending on how strong the inhibiting factor and how long the inhibition has been going on. Now the peculiar thing is that if the energy that is going out does not reach its term, that is its optimal functional expression, it cannot return to center. So that if we inhibit an outgoing energy, the energy trying to express itself turbulates on the underside of the inhibiting wall and generates a zone of congestion, a saturnine zone, which is the same as a contraction zone, a bad circulation zone, an organic breakdown zone. The only way we can release that is by removing the inhibiting factor. Sometimes when a person is inhibited over a long period, if we take the inhibitor away very quickly, they rush out in a wild, apparently hysterical outburst of strange activities. If at that moment you whip them into a straitjacket, you inhibit them again before they've got full expression. But if you give them a whole field to play in, they'll run about and discover what they're doing and eventually go home for tea. But society is so afraid of these demonstrations of unlocked inhibited powers that it always tries to put the straitjacket on you before you have time to finish your expression. Now, we had another question which is related to this.
What happens if the expression is very destructive to society? Is it not justified in after the direction?
If it is destructive to society, it can only be that society has inhibited it to that point. So society has asked for it. The question of justification is the question of the restatement of an equilibrium that's been lost. There is an individual within society, and here is society around the individual. The correct size for this individual is, we'll say, X. Society presses on it and reduces it considerably to X minus 12 or something. Now, society is actually destroying this individual. But the immanent spirit, which is the supreme justifier, is pressing out and determined to break those inhibitors. If society does not press, there are no inhibitors there to break. If it does press, at some stage, there will be a breakout. Because of this fact, there is a peculiar dynamic equilibrium. Society presses on the individual, imposes its inhibiting walls. At a certain point, the individual breaks out and hits back at society and kills a few. Society then hits back again, and this goes on for a few hundred years, until finally the back and forward conflict produces a new theory of the generation of psychopathic states. Freud is a kind of brick thrown into the psychological field, and he actually suggests that there are forces, he says sexual forces, trying to express themselves, and society is trying to stop them, and there is a fight. And he warns society about this kind of thing, and then goes pessimistic on it. Nietzsche, before him, makes the same thing about it. There is a fight between the inhibiting forces surrounding any given being and the immanent power of that being. This power exists. As the fight progresses, it becomes gradually conscious in society as a whole, that means all the individuals involved in the fight, that there must be a better way than knocking a man back into a padded cell every time he breaks out, because one never knows who's going to be knocked in next. So that even high government officials break down occasionally, and when they do, immediately they start saying, "Time we reform the nut houses, because we're going in, so we want better feeding." We have a question about a statement made that love never lets go of the object which first stirs it. You know that in Plato's theory, a person falls in love in the time process with something he's seen outside the time process. He's seen a perfect form outside the time process in this infinite field. He then enters the time process and he has inside him a memory of this perfect form. Now, the perfect form in infinity is a special kind, which we'll deal with at the moment. But the one in the time process is a compound. It's a compound of many things, desirable and undesirable, to a given being. So that when a man enters the time process and brings with him his vision of perfection from eternity, and then he sees a girl with a nose just like the one that he saw in eternity, but unfortunately she's got fallen arches as well. This is already a compound structure. The delight with the nose shape obscures the flat feet for the time being, and he marries the nose. On their nuptial night, he discovers that her feet are flat, and he feels slightly upset and let down. She should have said it. She should have taken her shoes off. He's been let down. Now, it is the nature of the time process to present you not with the pure perfection of eternity, but with a series of complex structures, elements of which will please and elements of which will annoy any given individual. And this is the function of time. Time is a device to force, as in this human means, to force evaluators, to force men to come to decisions about what they really want. It is a mode of forcing decision. Remove the time process completely, remove the circumframing factors completely, and choice becomes impossible. But as soon as we bring together a desirable and an undesirable in the same vehicle, then the person who takes it in the name of the desirable discovers something he didn't want to know. And this he didn't want to know is an essential part of the total knowledge of the action. So by putting together the perfect forms of eternity in certain configurations in the time, men who come into time looking for their eternal perfections find that they get with them some things they don't consider to be perfect. But these things which they get are essential parts of absolute knowledge. And to gain total perfection, one must understand all things, including the things one doesn't like. That is the function of the time process. Now, let's see what the original object of any being is. The original object of his loves. A being knows only the modifications of his own substance. So if a given being, here represented as a circle, is considered as finite, the original state of its substance, a kind of peculiar equilibrium, is a balance of powers which, as far as it is concerned, are the balance of powers of its own being. It is a peculiar balance, and this balance is its own peculiar balance, and this peculiar balance of his being is the perfection that he loves. If we complete the diagram, we see that all the stimulus points here are really centers of other circles. Every one of those stimulus points is the center of another circle. And so to identify with a finite being as finite is to forget that the motions internal to that finite being originate in the points round it of other centers. So the total equilibrium of a being, we could say, is seven. Around every circle there are six circles, and each one of those six is giving a characteristic stimulus. And the being itself has a centrally initiated one, we call the seventh. And this seventh one and the six stimuli exist in eternity in a peculiar balance. And this peculiar balance constitutes its first loved objective state. So that in eternity it is really a self-lover of the absolute order. And this equilibrium in eternity is at once its beginning, origin, source, and its aim when it's lost it. As soon as we throw such a being into the time process, which we do by simply superstressing it, it cannot see the centers round about it that are the sources of six of its characteristic motions. It feels its own will inside itself, and it feels the other six as interferences with this central will. So instead of accepting these six external originating motions, it tries to stop them or to interfere with them. It tries to impose on those six the seventh. Now, as soon as it does this, as soon as it starts rejecting stimuli that are coming to it from its perimeter, believing them to be from beyond itself, and not from the absolute substance, as soon as it begins to reject those, it has flung itself into the time process. It has also lost its eternal equilibrium and the loved object. It then proceeds to move through space in certain characteristic directions determined by the nature of the stimuli around him. He moves on a line of least resistance towards centres that appear to equilibrate him. Whatever centre offers him a temporary equilibrium, he moves towards it and thinks he loves it. He tries to appropriate that centre. But while he's moving towards, he's also moving away from other centres. And his correct position, his only eternally equilibrated position, is eternally fixed. So as long as he thinks that he has to keep moving in time to find his equilibrium by adding to himself beings from outside, he is producing the very disequilibrium he is trying to avoid. His first love, Lovenet, is simply himself in his state of absolute equilibrium. His second loved object in the time process is any other centre which appears to help him to equilibrate. And to such a centre he will tie himself. Such a wandering being trying to evolve, if he finds himself weak in one place, that's to say it finds itself weak in one place, a strong one will appear to it to be a male. And it will try to absorb that energy to balance itself up, and it will play woman to that invading strong energy. If it goes near a weak one, so the stimulus isn't strong enough, then it will start acting as a male on that weaker centre near it. Again, it's a hermaphroditic being in given relations. It can change polarity, change relatively its sexual attitude to another being. So when Plato talks about a man looking for his eternal other half, he's rather reducing the thing to a naive and external level. He actually knew better himself, because he always thought geometrically. It wasn't a question simply of a circle splitting into two halves and being separated in the time process and having to find each other in that way. It was something else. The two halves of the being are the will and the idea, or the intellect. Now, there's a certain amount of form in a person and a certain amount of will awareness in a person. The form in the person is the male aspect, the will in the person is the female aspect. These two have to be married together inside any single individual. That is to say, you have to make the will exactly coincident with the idea, and you have to make the idea exactly conform to the purpose of the will. When these two agree completely, then you have the perfect hermaphrodite, the perfect self-knowledgeable being who has become not a negative narcissist, but a self-realized being whose self has become the object of his own love. And he is then able, because of this identity, to love all things, because he cannot attain it in the time process. The two halves of the being are the will and the idea, or the intellect. Now, there's a certain amount of form in a person and a certain amount of will awareness in a person. The form in the person is the male aspect, the will in the person is the female aspect. These two have to be married together inside any single individual. That is to say, you have to make the will exactly coincident with the idea, and you have to make the idea exactly conform to the purpose of the will. When these two agree completely, then you have the perfect hermaphrodite, the perfect self-knowledgeable being who has become not a negative narcissist, but a self-realized being whose self has become the object of his own love. And he is then able, because of this identity, to love all things, because he cannot attain it in the time process. He can only attain it at the eternal level. The time process, by the nature of its serializing, is always disequilibrating. So that temporal love is necessarily dissatisfying. One can pretend that it isn't, for certain reasons of comfort on cold nights when the east wind blows. But in fact, because time is a serializing process, it is in disequilibrium. Because of that fact, you can never attain this perfection of satisfaction in the time process. The only way it can be gained is by non-identification with the serializing process. What you then gain is the marriage of the idea and willing yourself at the absolute level. And at that level, there are no other selves to fall in love with. All the selves there are internal to that absolute. And then you can love them all. But they are not other selves. They are simply selves within the absolute. So the peculiar nature of this positive fellow, as opposed to the negative narcissus. A negative narcissus is a being like the Mr. Universe. He's a very strange being to watch on a TV screen or elsewhere. Because he's not a bit like a woman. A Miss Universe is always aware that she gets a centre and that she's trying to make a relationship with the being outside herself. And this is perfectly obvious. The whole of her emotions, her awareness are beyond herself to create a relation. So she is essentially transcendent of the finite in particular, in her will. But the negative narcissist, the Mr. Universe type, if you observe him, you will see him looking at his own muscle with profound admiration, and his attention never goes outside his own existence. So he doesn't want a relation, and therefore he's quite useless to anybody except himself and the commercial gentleman that like to make fun of him on the cine camera. The absolute self-lover is the exact opposite of the negative, time-bound narcissist. Because the absolute one counts all beings as within his own field of awareness, counts them all as his properties, all equally under his care. So that he cannot favour any of them. He can only give to each one of them that which that one wants, that one needs, that one can utilise best, and that will help that one towards the same absolute realisation. So the original object seen in eternity for any being is simply the absolute object. He needs must love the highest when you see it. It's the same thing as saying I can never be satisfied with any finite, terrestrial, time-bound lover. You see this in certain churches where they train surplus women to devote themselves to this absolute concept. To some of them it's very, very helpful. It actually helps them to forget some of these terrestrial gentlemen whose nationality I shall not mention, and in so doing attain a kind of happiness of a non-individual order. Factually, in terms of exercise, practice for the individual, the only way this strange lover can be gained, this absolute lover, is by the making coincident within oneself of one's will and one's idea, which is the same thing again as absolute self-consistency. We have to have an idea of what ought to be done, and then we must have a will to do it. And if we have an idea of what ought to be done and a will that does something else, we are not coincident, and we are in a state of disequilibrium within ourselves, and therefore we're still in the time process. But if ever, even for a moment, we can balance the idea and the will perfectly, at that moment we leap out of the time process into the absolute. Again, that strange lover that mystics like to find. Have we any short questions before we retire?
Am I correct in saying that any operation of an individual, of either of any of the three senses, is substantial? It's a substantial activity. If he's thinking, he's feeling, or he's dirty, they're all equally substantial activities.
In so far as you are considering them within a boundary, yes. You're referring to some being.
Yes.
thinking, feeling, or acting.
Yes. In relation to the self, all substantial activities.
They're all substantial activities. So that feeling within a being, spiritual experience within a being, is substantial. Remember, there is no substance other than power substantiating itself. To think there is a substance other than power would be to be dualistic. We're looking for cause, and cause is power. And when the power is considered to be functioning within any zone whatever, it is called substance, which is still power. If you identify with a given zone and call that my zone, then you are talking about substantial power in that place. So that whether you are talking about spiritual phenomena welling up, or psychic states, feeling, appreciation, or physical activity, it is all substantial. There's a certain amount of inertia that will persist in equating substance with matter. But it need not be. Matter is only a behaviour of power, where it is rotating, it is ma-rota, ma-tura. And this tura function, the rotation, is what makes power into matter. So the body is a system of tiny rotations, and because of these rotations of power, we call it matter. But it is actually power, and this power is absolutely not different from one's will. And if it weren't for the pressure of stimuli from outside, this will would express itself. And it would go out seeking to develop its own potential. But if it didn't have a finite factor somewhere, there would be no return to centre and therefore no reflection.
If, as an exercise, I took somebody and did the exercise of identifying with them, what would I experience if I applied a law that I'd never known what the basis of my own self?
Then you'd experience an extension of the definition of my own substance.
I see. To include their substance.
Of course. But if you are identifying, you is the observer, the consciousness.
Yes.
You can do it now where you're sitting. There is someone on your right. There is someone behind you. If you identify with the someone on your right without looking out, and just feel, and then the same with the one behind you, and just feel, you'll get a qualitative difference in the feeling.
Yes.
Yes?
Yes.
But anybody can do this. If you feel your own organism as pure feeling experience, and then identify with another and feel that, you'll get a totally different feeling. And if you practice doing this, the inner form of the being you identify with springs up into your consciousness. Because there's no reason at all why the awareness in that place should confine itself to that place. It doesn't have to. It is doing so for a specific purpose of reflexive development. But it doesn't have to do it. You can break it by act of will.
Does the magical process need mechanicality in order to manifest?
Mechanicality is merely the form-motion aspect of will. There aren't two worlds, a mechanical world and the world of will. When you consider the formal behaviour of will as form, you're talking mechanical.
But a magical stimulus cannot manifest without a reaction to the stimulus.
You mean the limiting factor that causes it to return?
Yes.
We can't begin to define itself unless there is such a return.
That's what I mean,
it
can't manifest.
That's right, it can't make itself fast in order to evaluate itself. Manifest means evaluation fast, secure, which means defined. And you can't define unless you send the thing out from center, hit against a limiting factor, and it comes back. And in this act of reflection, you know what you've said.
I was thinking in terms of the statement we made in the first place of one person experiencing temper.
Mm-hmm.
And having come from, say, a third beer, but you see, it couldn't have come from the third beer unless the one that felt the temper had reacted. If he, was aware that something was taking place and wouldn't allow it, he couldn't.
Are you saying that centers cannot throw themselves with their own volition into bad temper? It sounds as if you're denying the freedom of other means to gain a bad temper if they're willing.
No, I wasn't thinking of that. I was thinking of the fact that someone becomes aware that temper is arising in him.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, it isn't mine, I'm not going to allow it.
Yeah.
So then it can't manifest.
Can't manifest through him.
Through him.
Well, that depends on his power level.
If he's got to the level where he will say that something is arriving which I haven't initiated, then I should have thought that he could prevent it.
No, that would be to get on the level where he can prevent it. You can feel things long before you can prevent them. A man can feel confused in the head without being able to sort it out. Although to feel confused is the first step to begin to sort it out. He isn't actually sorting it out. A man can be talking to a girl over a shop counter, and she happens to be 15 years younger than his wife, and very charming and very helpful. And the wife is at his side. He can feel the wife being aware that he has seen what a charming and helpful assistant this is, and he can feel that she's a bit mad at him, and that she's going to wig him in about 10 minutes over the coffee they're going to have. That doesn't mean that he can actually control it. He can feel it, that's one state. To control it is extra. The being can be at any level of awareness, but that level doesn't confer upon him power at the next higher level. It is quite an early level to become aware that people are hammering at you, that people are displeased with you, long before you can control your own reaction to their displeasure. You're at a very low level, you can't tell the people are a big man at you.
Is there a level where you can control their displeasure?
Oh, yes.
There is. It is possible.
Yes, fine. You can either control it, disperse it to infinity, so that the originator of it finds it disappearing, and if it's been absorbed in the void, and thinks that the temper has subsided when it's been taken away. Also, you can contract the field and return it to source, which isn't a very nice thing to do. Or heaping coals of fire on somebody's head. It's much nicer and cleaner exercise whenever you feel somebody really mad at you to get hold of the feeling and send it not back to the originator, but send it to infinity. And when it subsides in them, they feel a lot better. They're not chalking up against you for it, because they don't know that you've seen it. Meanwhile, they've had time to recover, to equilibrate, and to consider better how to behave next time. Now, if once you spot it, you say, this belongs to you, and I'm giving you back, hoping they chalk one up against you, because you've proved them in the wrong.
How many times this person has
been about? As we said before, the field itself will do anything whatever that you order it to do by a proper formal stimulus, that is a proper mental word. You have to have an exact coincidence between your will and your idea. You must understand the situation, that's the idea side, and you must have the will to use what you understand. So if you want a thing to go to infinity, you must know what infinity is. Obviously, a man that doesn't know what infinity is can't send anything there. He can only send it into something he doesn't know about. But if they understand that infinity is the removal of all these conceptual barriers, to throw it into that is to throw it into a non-conceptualized continuum. Then nobody gets it.
Now this is a shift of identification again.
Yes. And the word is the instrument whereby you identify. The word is still the single most powerful stimulus in the world. World politics, world religions, world science, anything else, is completely determined by the available vocabulary in each field.